Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale is a big underground rock that contains vast amounts of natural gas. Whether extracting that gas is good for the economy or an environmental threat, or both, is hotly debated. But efforts to settle that question scientifically have been hampered by a lack of funding, insufficient data, and claims of bias. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
This is a story about how government makes decisions when science is involved. And not just science. Jobs, public health, the environment, local tax revenue, and even America's energy future are all playing out in Pennsylvania's sudden natural gas drilling boom. Here's how Governor Tom Corbett sees it.
We need to protect the water. We need to protect the environment. But we must do it based on science, not emotion.
Most Pennsylvanians now know that the Marcellus Shale is a very old rock that lies thousands of feet beneath forests and dairy farms. And that rock has a lot of natural gas. But some fear drilling will poison water supplies and turn a pristine forested area into an industrial zone. So what does this have to do with a bunch of scientists looking for salamanders deep in a forest in north-central Pennsylvania?
Oh, it's a fairly bright one. Are you talking about the darker, redder color?
Researchers from Philadelphia's Academy of Natural Sciences scour a small stream for salamanders, brook trout, and algae. It's part of a larger effort to measure the impact of natural gas drilling on the streams that run thousands of feet above nearby gas wells. Salamanders, it turns out, can tell us a lot about changes in water quality. They're very sensitive, so they serve as good indicators to change. About 1,600 Marcellus Shale gas wells are operating in Pennsylvania today, but data on their environmental impact are hard to find.
There's a lack of data because this particular technology in this setting is very new.
That's Richard Harwitz, a senior biologist with the Academy of Natural Sciences. The regulation of gas drilling in Pennsylvania and elsewhere is left to the states. The federal government collects no uniform data on the practice, and that, Harwitz says, has researchers playing catch-up. But who pays for this needed research? Not much state government funding is available, and more scientists are staying away from industry funding. Diane Schrouth is with Philadelphia's William Penn Foundation, and she says researchers are now turning to foundations like hers for money.
They are struggling to not appear biased, you know, so many of them won't take industry funding.
One institution that has garnered a lot of criticism for doing so is Penn State, which some activists accuse of acting as a cheerleader for Marcellus Shale drilling. Michael Arthur is a professor of geoscience at Penn State and the head of the Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research. Arthur says he does take industry money for some of his own research because it helps buy updated equipment for his students. But he says he's careful not to take industry money for research that looks at controversial gas drilling practices, like his work on how methane may leak into private water wells.
You know, the research I'm involved in, the stray gas, that's not industry funded. I wouldn't take industry money for that at this point.
Industry spokespeople say they, too, are committed to good science. And, if anything, they contend that there's bias on the environmental side of the issue. Travis Windell is a spokesman for the Marcellus Shale Coalition, a group that includes about 95% of the companies drilling in Pennsylvania. Windell says gas companies do respond to good science.
A perfect example is how we proactively dealt with the wastewater discharge.
Up until last spring, drillers in Pennsylvania had been sending wastewater to municipal treatment facilities that were not equipped to clean it, leading to the discharge of polluted water into the state's rivers and streams.
Now, because of straightforward science and facts that were put forth by some Carnegie Mellon researchers, we said we're going to unilaterally, as an industry, as an organization, stop these practices.
Back in the forest, Richard Harwitz shrugs when asked about what he might discover about the impact of gas drilling on aquatic life.
Whatever answer we come up with, there may be some people who assume we were bought off.
Harwitz says he probably won't have an answer until the end of 2012. And will that be soon enough for politicians like Governor Corbett to make good decisions? For NPR News, I'm Susan Phillips.
Our book today is the story of a legendary leader told by his protege, who is something of a legend in his own right. The book is called Ben-Gurion, A Political Life. It's a memoir of Israel's founding prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. And the co-author is Shimon Peres, the Nobel Peace Laureate and current president of Israel. Peres was just 23 years old when he became a trusted advisor to Ben-Gurion. Over a two-year period, Peres sat down with writer David Landau to talk about his mentor. Shimon Peres also sat down with us this past week to talk about the book, and I asked him why he thinks Ben-Gurion chose him.
I really don't know. Maybe it was wrong. Maybe it was a mistake. He was very much criticized because he picked me up. They say, who is this young man coming from nowhere, practically uneducated, from a kibbutz and so on? But then Ben-Gurion told them, some of them, when Shimon enters the room, I know three things. A, he will not ask anything for himself. Secondly, that he will not smear anybody else. And thirdly, he has apparently a new idea.
You say that the most critical decision he made was his acceptance of partition. Of course, right. The concept of two states. For many people looking back today, it doesn't seem particularly brave. But can you explain the context of why you believe that was such a crucial decision?
Two reasons. Some of them wanted the wholeness of Israel, what they call the Greater Israel. They thought this is more important than to have a state. The second reason is the map was terrible. Most of the land was given to the Palestinians. It's not like today when you say two states for two peoples. The 67 map is different from the 47 map. In the 47 map, we have had 22% less than now. So they say, what are you doing? You divide the land, and you are satisfied with a map which is impossible to live on. And Ben-Gurion said, yes, in spite of it, I think to create a state is the most important and urgent story. It was immediately after the Holocaust, and to our great disappointment. The ones who were saved from the Holocaust couldn't find a land to be there. All the ports were closed. So he says, let's have a state, even on a small land, but we can absolve the ones that were saved from the Holocaust.
Mm. I want to ask you about Ben-Gurion personally, because You acknowledge that he could be prickly. He could be even mean to people who he loved, like his wife, even you at times, right?
Well, first of all, he was a man of his words. Hmm. If he said something, you can hang on it with blind eyes. You don't have to worry. And he will do it under the most difficult circumstances, so you know where he stands. Since I worked with him, I knew exactly what I can permit myself and what is unforgivable. With Ben-Gurion, if you lie once, it's the end of your career. But if you dare and if you fail, that's okay. Daring is permitted, lying is not accepted. I mean, for me, it was a great luck to meet such a great person, unique in history, because he was the prime minister of a country that he wasn't born. He was the leader of the people that were dispersed, not in the land. He was the head of heading a war without an army. Look around. There are not many people like him.
I'm speaking with Shimon Peres, the Nobel laureate and president of Israel, about his new book. It's called Ben-Gurion. There was a narrative at the time, before the state was created, that Palestine was this empty land simply waiting to be populated. You remember that Ben-Gurion warned against pushing this idea, that in fact he said, look, there are people living here, and we need to understand that.
Sure. Look, Ben-Gurion wrote several books. One of them is called We Are Now Neighbors. And it says the idea that we are coming to an empty land is not a true idea. The idea of the Zionist in the beginning, which was idealistic, they said a people without a state is looking for a state without the people. Well, that was the true situation. There were Palestinians. By the way, the Palestinians never have had a state, you see. But anyway, Ben-Gurion says, we have to understand there are Arabs or Palestinians, and we have to develop with them fair relations on a democratic basis.
Shimon Peres, Israel today seems to be increasingly isolated diplomatically. And in Ben-Gurion's day, he talked about Israel being a light unto nations. I wonder what you think Ben-Gurion would make of Israel's position in the world today. Would he be disappointed? Would he be surprised?
Well, Israel is isolated in one way, but also admired in another way, you know. We are the only democracy in the Middle East. It's very hard to be a democracy in an undemocratic region. And also, when you look at the achievement over 63 years, fighting 7 wars, 2 intifadas, coming to a land that the size of its land is so small, my God, without water, you know, we have 2 lakes, one is dead, the other is dying. And yet, to be one of the best agricultural in the world. So look, from that side, you may see it a little bit different. We are being criticized politically, I know, and I hope we shall achieve peace with the Palestinians. So I think this criticism, too, will go down. But look at the achievement. Even when there is a lot of darkness, a single candle can be a light.
What do you think he would have made of Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Well, I don't want to speculate about it. I want to tell you one thing. Ben-Gurion told me time and again, don't judge people upon the stories around them, upon the rumors. He would probably tell me, take the record and judge.
If Ben-Gurion were still alive today, what do you think would keep him up at night about Israel?
He would like that this country will be moved into 2 directions, to be as old and as small as the 10 Commandments, and to be as daring and modern as the science of today.
Shimon Peres, one question for you. Now you are 1 year older than when Ben-Gurion died. You are very vibrant. You are engaged. You're obviously the president of the country. What's your secret? What's your exercise regimen, by the way?
Well, too, you know, first of all, never lose your curiosity. If you lose it, you're dead. Never fall into boredom. And I'm thanking heaven for this great occasion to be a servant of the people. From Ben-Gurion, I learned what does it mean to be a leader. When it comes to a success, then it's we. When it comes to a failure, it's I. A leader shouldn't try to be on the top. He should try to be ahead, not to rule, but to advance.
That's Israeli President and Nobel Peace Laureate Shimon Peres. He's the co-author of a new book on the life of his political mentor. It's called Ben-Gurion. President Peres, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Holiday spending is up a little bit this Christmas season, but many people remain on tight budgets, and the truth is that many of us don't like spending too much at Christmas anyway, which doesn't mean we don't want to enjoy it. And that's where Nigella Lawson comes in. She's offering us some suggestions from her book, Nigella Christmas, on how to do Christmas pleasantly on a budget. She's a regular guest on this program, a TV chef. Hi, Nigella.
Hello.
And welcome back once again. Let's start, I suppose, with an appetizer. You have a recipe here for, well, potato skins.
I do, and I have to say straight away that these recipes came to me just out of greed, not out of budgetary concerns. And I think in a way this is quite important because, you know, one should always try and do food that is just as good as any luxury dish would be. Mm-hmm. And actually, so they are potato skins. They're my fully loaded potato skins. And this time of year it makes sense because I think you need a lot of carbohydrate.
Okay.
Maybe unfashionable, but it's cold and maybe you're drinking a lot. But this is quite strange because I'm giving you back a recipe that I got via America. So it's really my thank you present.
Oh, this is a very American dish, potato skins.
It really is. And so really it's just a question of, you know, baking potatoes, splitting them in half, taking out all that, you know, soft cooked potato meat. Mm-hmm. And then let the potato meat get cold, or flesh maybe it is really well the meat. You let that get cold. You let the husks sort of dry out a little so that they become vessels for eating the rest of the potato later. I let them dry out because the great thing about this, you can do most of it in advance, well, all of it. And then on the day you've got your friends coming over, I like sour cream and some grated cheese and maybe some scallions and a bit of Worcestershire sauce. Now, I pop those back into their skins and put them in the oven. Now, I actually like them with bacon as well. So I think you either can do the little bacon bits and put them on top, or you can put them in cute little bowls for people to pass around.
Now, you said that greed attracts you to these particular dishes. Is that partly because some of the simpler dishes, the less expensive dishes, you can just make more and more and more of it?
Well, I suppose so, but I do think that really, at key times of the year, like the holidays, what one really wants are the simpler, more traditional foods. I don't know that I want anything giddyingly fancy. Mm-hmm. And I think also food tends to have to be multi-generational. So it's absolutely pointless cooking something that if you've got a 7-year-old and a 70-year-old, you know, you want to make everyone happy.
I wonder if this lasagna that you've suggested here would have the same effect.
Well, the lasagna I adore, and it's a pumpkin and goat's cheese lasagna. I love this because it not only is, you know, vegetarians like it, which isn't obviously my main concern as a meat eater, but again, it's something you cook ahead. And obviously, if you're dispensing with meat, you're probably doing away with the most expensive part of any meal. But there's something so festive about this. I suppose a huge tray of lasagna always is pretty festive, but the scent of the spiced pumpkin and that sharpness of the cheese, and it creates a slight lake at the bottom, so you have to give people bread to mop it up. And even though it's a pumpkin lasagna, if it's easier for you to chop up some butternut squash, I mean, by all means do that. I'm pretty easygoing about that. But the reality is, it's very basic. There's sweet and there's sharp, and then there's the tangy sauce, and then, of course, that incredible, comforting smoothness of a lasagna. And I don't make my own pasta here, though I could, and I would encourage anyone to, but I would also encourage anyone who hasn't got the time to buy some soft, as it were, fresh lasagna, so you don't have to pre-boil it.
So isn't it time, maybe past time, for a drink?
I know. I wondered when you were going to offer me something to drink, or whether I asked me to offer you one.
Oh, please.
Okay, do you want to know? This is what I give everyone before they come for lunch on the 25th of December, and was very useful 1 year because one of my ovens broke. Mm-hmm. And so that lunch was at 4 rather than at 2.
Oh.
And it's called, I call it a poinsettia, because obviously it's a very seasonal plant, and this is a red drink. And I will give you the wherewithal to make it, and make one bottle of fizz, you know, stretch. So it's delicious, but I'm going to pretend now it's just really, really good economical sense, which it is, but that's secondary. You're not having to go out and buy, you know, 8 different liqueurs.
It's straightforward.
So you have a bottle of Prosecco, any fizzy dry wine, doesn't have to be premium. And then for that, half a cup of any orange liqueur, which you can get pretty well. Orange liqueur is not a fancy one. And then 2 cups of cranberry juice. Now, if you wanted to, there's nothing to stop you really missing out, you know, the orange liqueur. It would still be delicious, but let me tell you, with the orange liqueur in it, not only is it fantastic, but the dangerous thing is it doesn't taste alcoholic. Oh. I'm just warning everyone now.
Have
please.
4 or 5 before you know what you're
Well,
doing.
All I can say is no one even noticed lunch was 2 hours late when my oven broke. And that is the truth.
Oh, that's great. Now, let's move on to one more thing here. If we've still got a little bit of room for some gingerbread.
I think you have to have gingerbread, not least it smells so wonderful. You know, the ginger, cinnamon, cloves, molasses, butter. Oh, it's so delicious. But the reality is with this gingerbread is it's very easy because you make it all in a pan. So you're not actually creaming anything. You just put all the relevant ingredients into a saucepan. You know, you heat it and then stir everything together. And then I throw everything into, I use a foil tin because it's easier. You can store the gingerbread in it afterwards as well. And you just bake it for about, I don't know, 45 minutes, 60 minutes, depending on how hot your oven runs. Mm-hmm. And if you can bear it, you know, leave it for a day or two and it will get stickier and stickier. But it's so wonderful just with a cup of tea or coffee. And of course, it doesn't hurt at this time of year to have something you could take over to friends where you're visiting.
So will you be making this sticky gingerbread for your guests this Christmas?
Always. Absolutely always. And also, even though it's completely like going into a different register, because after all, ginger is the taste of the tropics, it's a fantastic, if you want to upscale it somewhat to a dinner party dessert, I get some cube mangoes and cube them and serve that with it. And then a little bit of dusting of, you know, if you dust a bit of powdered sugar through a sieve on top of anything, it suddenly looks more expensive. That's what you do.
Nigella Lawson, it's always a pleasure talking with you.
And you.
Her many books include Nigella Christmas, and you can find recipes for pumpkin goat cheese lasagna and sticky gingerbread at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Millions of Americans are struggling to pay off debts, and debt collectors have found a modern way to employ a very old tactic. Debtors' prisons were abolished in this country well over a century ago, yet some of today's debtors are shocked to find themselves in jail. Susie Ahn reports from member station WBEZ in Chicago.
Imagine you're driving home and an officer pulls you over for having a loud muffler. But instead of sending you off with a warning, you're arrested and taken right to jail. That's what happened to Robin Sanders in Illinois.
That's when I found out I had a warrant for failure to appear in Macoupin County, and I didn't know what it was about.
Sanders owed $730 on a medical bill. She says she didn't even know a collection agency filed a lawsuit against her.
They say they send out these court notices and nobody gets them.
Sanders spent 4 days in jail waiting for her father to raise $500 for her bail. That money was then turned over to the collection agency. Robin Sanders' story is an increasingly common one across the country, in Indiana, Tennessee, and Washington. Here's how it happens. A company will often sell off its debt to a collection agency, often called a creditor. That creditor files a lawsuit against the debtor, requiring a court appearance. A notice is supposed to be given to the debtor, and if they fail to appear in court, a warrant is issued for their arrest. Beverly Yang is a legal aid attorney with Land of Lincoln Legal Assistance. Yang says most debtors don't know their rights. In fact, she says some judges don't even know the debtor's rights. That could result in the debtor being intimidated into a pay agreement.
And I've seen this even when I'm standing in the courtroom as the legal aid attorney. The judge will ask if they can pay, how about $150 a month? How about $75 a month? How come you can't even pay $50 a month? Did you apply for a job last week?
The Federal Trade Commission received more than 140,000 complaints related to debt collection in 2010. That's nearly 25,000 more than the previous year. Yang says some creditors are eager to use harsh tactics.
Whatever the creditors or the creditors' attorneys can do to leverage some kind of payment, it will help their profits enormously because they have literally millions of these.
There's an assumption in what you're saying is that we would rather throw them in jail than work with them. And I don't find that to be true at all.
That's Kevin Kelly, president of the Illinois Creditors Bar Association. He says members of his organization only issue warrants in extreme situations. Kelly says sometimes it's the debtor who's keeping information from the collectors. That prevents important documents from getting to the right place. He says most collectors want to make reasonable arrangements, but it's difficult when the vast majority don't even respond to any notices sent to them. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan thinks more can be done. It's illegal in Illinois for people to be sent to jail because they're in debt. But Madigan thinks some creditors are abusing the law.
You wouldn't be in that predicament if you didn't have debt. I mean, you know, but for being in debt, you wouldn't be in prison. And that essentially equates to being thrown in jail, you know, debtor's prison.
Madigan says courts need to be certain they have correct information to serve notices. She also says judges need to be properly educated in these proceedings to prevent a debtor from needlessly going to jail. Madigan says the state is also investigating agencies that it thinks are abusing the law. As for Sanders, she has a remaining balance of about $160 on her medical bill. But at least she now knows she won't have to go to jail for it. For NPR News, I'm Susie Ahn in Chicago.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Millions of Americans have personal experience with the story we'll hear next. It's the story of what it's like to spend a year or more out of work in this economy. Data from an NPR Kaiser Family Foundation poll reveals some of the ways that the long-term unemployed have been getting by. And this survey begins an NPR series called Still No Job. Even those who woke up telling themselves that today will know from these findings that at least they're not alone. NPR's John Itzde has our first installment.
Here are some of the poll's findings. Close to half of those surveyed say they've had trouble paying for housing and food. Over half told us they've borrowed money from friends or family to get by. A third say they've changed their living situation to save money, including moving in with relatives and friends. And 1 in 10 say they've lost their home due to foreclosure. Virtually all that is true for Lynn Daniel, whose most recent work was building websites for small businesses. Right now, she's living with a friend in Albany, New York.
I'm not homeless, and I probably never will be. But everything that I had and everything I worked for is gone. I played the game the way I was, quote, supposed to, you know, house, marriage. I had the cat instead of the dog, but, you know, and nothing. It's all gone.
The federal government currently counts 5.7 million Americans as long-term unemployed, which it defines as people out of work for 27 weeks or more. The NPR Kaiser poll used a slightly different measure. It surveyed people out of work for a year or more, and only 13% said they are currently collecting unemployment benefits. The poll also interviewed people working part-time who want full-time work. One goal of the poll was to focus on personal and emotional health effects. About 1 in 3 said both their mental and physical health is worse. David Supon of Buffalo, New York, says being out of work is stressful.
I could say I'm depressed, because I think I am a little bit.
Supon's last job was managing the construction of a clean coal plant in Ohio. It paid well into the six figures.
You know, you think you're valuable in your mind, and you want to offer your talents to somebody, and you get rejected, and, you know, it's rough.
About half of those surveyed said they currently have no health insurance, and close to 60% said they've put off getting health care that they needed. Not surprisingly, nearly a quarter said that lack of work has been hard on their marriages. But interestingly, almost as many said it has had a positive effect on their relationship with their children. As for their employment prospects, most are not optimistic, including Lynn Daniel.
If I put my hopes in finding another job, I just break my heart. To be honest, I've given up.
A strong majority of those polled say they don't have much confidence they'll get full-time work. 70% would like the government to offer more job training opportunities and placement services. But only about 1 in 10 believe that government efforts to deal with the poor economy has helped them. Jerry Sweden, an unemployed construction project manager, expresses that cynicism, starting with President Obama's stimulus program.
A lot of it was supposed to be construction, but I really haven't been able to catch on to any of it.
After losing his job in Florida, Sweden moved in with his mother in Romulus, Michigan. He's also disgusted with congressional bickering that's held up aid for the unemployed.
Extending the unemployment, you know, and they sit there and they stretch it out, and then 2 weeks after they were supposed to vote on it, then they vote on it. But in the meantime, you know, they put all these people through emotional hell.
As for dishing out blame, 70% in the survey said Wall Street institutions and Republicans in Congress bear a lot or some of the blame for the situation the country's in today. A little more than half blame Democrats in Congress, while fewer than half blame President Obama. But those numbers reflect the fact that the long-term unemployed and underemployed identify themselves as Democrat or Democrat-leaning by 2-1. That leaves their potential impact on the election next November unclear. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
On a Monday morning, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. And in your health on this Monday, teens and alcohol. But first, we're going to talk about road rage. It's not unusual, of course, for awful traffic conditions or incompetent driving to make some people really angry behind the wheel. But maybe that's not really why people are angry. Road rage, it turns out, can be a symptom of deeper emotional problems, as NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
When Mike Shen moved to Los Angeles, he acquired a new fear, road rage. Take the time he was viciously tailgated by a woman driving a beat-up Jeep.
She got so angry that she started pacing me to my right. She wasn't looking at the road in front of her. She was driving right next to me, literally yelling out her window racial epithets at the top of her lungs.
After that, Shen decided to take his road rage into the digital age.
I started a blog called lacantdrive.com.
Shen says the blog is cathartic because Los Angeles is home to some of the worst driving he's ever seen.
Just the other day, I saw someone merging onto the 134 freeway with a newspaper completely spread out in front of them. Like literally in my rear view mirror, I saw just a spread out 2-page newspaper.
Shen says maybe it's because people spend so much time in their cars, they try to multitask.
Well, maybe I can eat an apple behind the wheel. And then from there, I said, well, if I'm eating an apple, maybe I can try to steer with my knee and eat a bowl of cereal behind the wheel, which I've seen. Or shaving. I see that all the time. Or doing their makeup.
Surveys show the more drivers are distracted, the more other drivers get angry and start honking, cursing, making obscene gestures, waving their fists in the air. Michael Bush is an official with the Road Club Auto Vantage. In their annual survey, they ask members about bad driving.
Did you curse at another driver? Did you make an obscene gesture towards another driver? Perhaps wave your fist in anger? And interestingly, we also asked, you know, have you ever purposefully slammed your vehicle into another car?
Deliberately slamming your vehicle into another car? The startling answer is yes.
Oddly, in Washington, D.C., you're four times as likely to have someone drive into you on purpose than anywhere else on the planet.
Clearly an extreme example of road rage. But this type of outburst, says psychiatrist Emil Cacaro with the University of Chicago, may signal a deeper underlying problem. It's called intermittent explosive disorder, and it happens on the road, at home, and even on the job.
Those outbursts can be temper tantrums, could be throwing things around, breaking things, pushing, shoving, hitting people.
Aggression like this, says Cacaro, can be caused by any number of emotional problems. For example, paranoia.
If somebody gets in their face, they're going to be threatened and they're going to respond aggressively to that. So who are you looking at? You know, why are you looking at me like that?
Some people are emotionally unstable and explode when they're rejected. Others are compulsively rigid and explode when their sense of order is upset.
Their fuse for exploding is very, very short. So something happens they're not happy with. There's not much time for them to think of other ways to handle their reaction to it.
That fuse is short for a number of biological reasons. For starters, Cacaro says, people don't produce enough of the happy hormone serotonin.
Serotonin is thought to be a behavioral inhibitor. It's basically the brakes. And if your brakes are bad, you're going to get into trouble.
At the same time, people produce too many brain chemicals that promote aggression. It's a dangerous combination, but one that can be treated. Medications like antidepressants and mood stabilizers can restore the brain's chemical balance. Cognitive behavior therapy helps patients not take things so personally. And Cacaro says there are coping techniques.
One of the simplest strategies for that is called a timeout, and you just leave. You say, excuse me, I gotta go. You get out and you try to soothe yourself.
Now, you can't get out and leave if you're in your car, but you can stop engaging in the aggressive behavior. These techniques won't completely cure the disorder, but they certainly can help contain the explosions. Patty Namond, NPR News.